We are recording. We're good. All right. Welcome back, everyone. It's the Grim Lord here, and this is Grim Articles Show with Dead Penetration. Now, we're going to talk about the articles. The spoilers are done, guys. We're completely done spoiling you. We're not even going to talk about the movie. Go see it. It's good. You like gore and stuff, you'll see some. So check it out. It's good. Anyway, let's go ahead and get started. We have a bunch of articles to cover. So... Oh, we have some Grim Show chats. They're probably telling me what the fuck's going on. Oh, he said, yeah, it's been hot as balls here, too. Yeah, it's hot as fucking balls. It is fucking hot. We're both about to be shirtless in a few... I mean, it's a good thing you guys can't get the video version of this, because, yeah, it's not gonna be too great. Chippendales. Yeah, I don't know about
that. The Grim Shows.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Very grim.
That'd be too grim. I mean, I have been lifting. I don't look as bad as I used to, but, I mean, it's still, yeah. Let's see here. Let's start. Aliens? Utopia? Oh, shit, there's a lot here. Oh, that's a good one. Okay. Shit, there's a lot. Okay, I'm sorry, guys. We really went far. Okay, we're not going to talk about that one yet. There's some funny ones we can do, but let's talk about this. You probably didn't even know this happened, did you?
Well,
you'll find out. Just give me a minute. Now, I will warn you, something's wrong with my phone, so it's giving me, like, low bars. I don't fucking know why. It's weird, but we're going to continue anyway. Okay, Rolling Stone. Rob Kardashian testifies, Black China tried to kill me, gets upset when challenged with video. The sole Kardashian brother told jurors that he met Black China during his lowest point and that their relationship was a sham for the cameras. Rob Kardashian, the admittedly reclusive younger brother of Kim, made a rare public appearance in the Los Angeles courtroom Wednesday and claimed his ex-fiance Black China tried to kill him during a wild fight in 2016 that allegedly included a gun to his head, strangulation with an iPhone cord, and beating with a 6-foot metal rod.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she went fucking Streets of Rage on his ass. And, of course, they want me to read the whole story, but...
Yeah, that's a turn-off when they try to kill you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, I have that covered because they wanted me to read the whole story, and I just pulled up Archive. All right, so... Alright, the sole Kardashian's son, 35, started off slow, telling jurors he was at his weakest, lowest point when he started dating China in 2016 after spending time in the hospital related to his diabetes. He's a big guy, so yeah, it can happen. He said the relationship, which quickly hit warp speed, was mostly fueled by China's quest for celebrity, not real love. That's all she wanted. It makes sense. Describing the blowout fight on December 15, 2016, that's now at the center of China's defamation claims against his mom, Kris Jenner, and sisters Khloe and Kim Kardashian and youngest sister Kylie, Rob claimed China was drunk, high, and relentless. He claimed China pointed a gun at his head in the kitchen, then again in a bedroom, wrapped an iPhone cord around his neck, and broke down a door to beat him with a metal rod in the bedroom in his closet.
How big is that Black China?
I don't know. Let's go look at a picture of this Black China. I mean, yeah, I think of China, I think of
the wrestler. Yeah. Oh, this is just a blacker version?
I don't know. Well, I'm looking at this girl now. Maybe she got a little bit of meat on her bones. I don't know. Lord. She done got... God damn, look at that woman. She just looked bad. Look at that face. It looked like a stone. Just weird. It looked like a weird Asian stone face thing. That's her. That's her.
Huh. That looks like Kim Kardashian, the first picture does.
Yeah, that is Kim Kardashian.
Well, yeah, Black China's.
Black China, that one.
She
Boy,
does
she
looked like a chunky monkey.
Well, I mean, there's a picture of her right there.
Not in a racist sense, but I just like saying chunky monkey.
It's all right. We give German shepherds all the negativity here, I guess you say. All the toxicity. That's what Drex would want anyway.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go back to this. She landed several blows to my body, my face, and my back. Yeah, there were several, he testified Wednesday, saying with each new stage of China's alleged violent attack, he simply weathered the blows and tried to remove himself from the situation without fighting back. She tried to kill me, he said at one point, with Mom Chris and Sister Kim watching the courtroom gallery. Rob, who's due to face a separate revenge porn trial next month over naked photos of her, he posted on his Instagram account, then turned visibly agitated when her lawyer confronted him on the witness stand with photos and videos which he had no apparent marks on his face and neck in the days. Oh. Oh, man. Okay, now, basically they said you testified under oath that China hit you in the face with a 6-foot metal rod, and yet you're saying it didn't leave a mark of any kind on your face, his lawyer asked. He said, correct. Did you have as much of a Band-Aid on you after this alleged severe beating? He said, no, I didn't need a Band-Aid on my face, which I already testified to. I had no mark on my face, he replied, appearing to lose his patience. How did you not have a mark on your face, the lawyer asked, incredulous. Because I didn't leave a mark. I'm just confused. I just told you it didn't leave a mark on my face, and you have 3 different pictures to prove that. I'm trying to tell you it did not leave a mark on my face, he responded, appearing to get more worked up. Right, and I'm trying to... Chiani continued before Rob cut her off. The gun to my head 2 different times in the night didn't leave a mark to my temple. The cord around my neck, I'm sure it left a mark around my neck. It doesn't mean I'm going to go to the hospital and put a Band-Aid around my neck, he responded. When the lawyer tried to switch the topic back to the metal rod, he cut her off again. I never said I had bruises and marks all over my face. You're acting like the thing didn't happen. Everything I testified to happened. She strangled me. She put a gun to my head 2. She was on cocaine and alcohol. She has a history of doing this to her ex-baby daddy. She has a history of doing this type of thing, he said. Stop putting it out there like that. It's not fair, he demanded. He was called to the witness stand by a lawyer on the 7th day of a trial accusing of defaming China. So, basically, in a testimony last week, she and Rob were celebrating at home together the night of 2016 after E! Released a press release saying season 2 of the show had been picked up by E! Network. She testified that she was being silly with Rob, throwing money around, picking up an unloaded gun and placing an iPhone cord to his neck, and lighthearted bids for his attention. What? She testified that Rob later stole her cell phone in a fit of jealousy and locked himself in a room with it, refusing to give it back.
It sounds like he ran for his life and locked himself in a room.
The 33-year-old model and influencer admitted she smashed a gingerbread house, a television set, and a door in the Hidden Hills, California mansion because she was frustrated and wanted a phone. She was adamant she never physically abused him. She said it was true she moved out of the house hours after the confrontation, but she testified she still considered herself engaged to Rob and spent time with him over the holidays and into New Year, filming scenes for season 2 and parenting the couple's newborn daughter, Dream. An underlying lawsuit, China claims that Kim and claims that Chris, Chloe, Kim, and Kylie conspired to kill the second season with defamatory claims that she battered Rob during December 15th and was generally abusive of what they called the couple's fake and toxic relationship. Wow. It also says, Chris' boyfriend Corey Gamble testified Tuesday that he raced over to the house the morning of the fight witnessed China toss something resembling a rod to the ground before punching him several times. On Wednesday, when the lawyer showed jurors a Snapchat video of Rob and smiling and celebrating New Year's Eve 2016 with China at a steakhouse, 2 weeks after the alleged attack, she asked Rob if the seemingly happy social media post reflected a good time. He said, no, Rob responded. I have social anxiety. I'm very insecure with my body. I gained a lot of weight. I don't like to leave the house because it upsets me. And she forced me to come up out of the house. And she said she'd pick me up. And of course, I'm just trying to keep it cool. It's New Year's, so I went to dinner, and that was that. But I wasn't happy to answer the question. So that sounds like a fucking load of crazy crap, folks.
And you notice... A lot of times in a courtroom when they're doing all that, she's just an innocent woman. Don't badger her like this or whatever. But
oh, yeah.
It just depends on the court and the courtroom, probably the location of it in the country.
All that, yes. Invader Tech says, it sounds like something for Sick Women Files. I'm not sure what that is. I think it might be a show on Information Discovery.
I'll have to look it up.
Oh, Lord.
Deadly women. There's
deadly women. Woof. Good Lord. Watch enough of that. Let's see here. This is interesting. A friend of mine sent me this. This is important. It's from history. We'll open it with this. All right, this is from history. 1947, October the 20th, Congress investigates communists in Hollywood. On October the 20th of 1947, the notorious Red Scare kicks into high gear in Washington as Congressional Committee begins investigating communist influence in one of the world's richest and most glamorous communities, Hollywood. After World War II, the Cold War began to heat up between the world's two... Hold on, I don't know what they were doing here. No, I don't want that. Okay, you know how they give you these ads. Alright, anyway... After World War II, the Cold War began to heat up between the world's two superpowers, the United States and the communist-controlled Soviet Union. In Washington, conservative watchdogs worked to out communists in government before setting their sights on alleged Reds in the famously liberal movie industry. An investigation that began in October of 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee, the HUAC, which we probably need again, grilled a number of prominent witnesses, asking bluntly, are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? Now, what do you think would happen today if we had a bunch of people in Hollywood ask that same question? Are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? How many people do you think in today's Hollywood would actually say, yes, I support communism? Well, a lot.
Yeah, probably.
A lot. And that's a problem. Whether out of patriotism or fear, some witnesses, including director Elia Kazan, actors Gary Cooper and Robert Taylor, and studio honchos Walt Disney and Jack Warner, gave the committee names of colleagues they suspected of being communists. A small group known as the Hollywood Ten resisted, complaining that the hearings were illegal and violated their First Amendment rights. They were all convicted of obstructing the investigation and served jail terms. Pressured by Congress, the Hollywood establishment started a blacklist policy, banning the work of about 325 screenwriters, actors, and directors who had not been cleared by the committee. These blacklisted included composer Aaron Copland, writers Dashiell Hammett, Lillian Hellman, and Dorothy Parker, playwright Arthur Miller, and actor and filmmaker Orson Welles. Some of the blacklisted writers used pseudonyms to continue working, while others wrote scripts that were credited to other writer friends. Starting in the early 1960s, after the downfall of Senator Joseph McCarthy, the most public face of anti-communism, the ban began to lift slowly. In 1997, the Writers Guild of America unanimously voted to change the writing credits of 23 films made during the blacklist period, reversing, but not erasing, some of the damage done during the Red Scare. So that is kind of interesting, but a friend of mine wanted me to see that. Because I didn't know much about... All right, now we've got another one here. We're still in April, but we're almost at the end of April as far as the articles are concerned. Okay, layoffs at Netflix has some staffers questioning company strategy and culture. At Netflix, it has been long known that an adequate performance gets a generous service package. The Los Gatos, California company views its roughly 11,300 employees as members of a pro sports team, where every player has to be a star performer or else they're gone, reflecting what the company calls a keeper test, or a team, not a family, Netflix says of its culture. But what happens when the entire team's performance is called into question? Last week, Netflix said it lost subscribers for the first time in more than a decade, shedding 200,000 subs in the first quarter and expected to lose 2 million more this quarter. This disclosure unnerved their investors, who wondered if the streaming giant had lost its golden touch. Shares plummeted 35% on April 20th, its biggest one-day decline since 2004. Responding to the dramatic slowdown, Netflix said it would test ways to encourage people to pay for sharing passwords, put out better shows, films, and games. They're going to start doing games on Netflix. And explore a lower-cost, ad-supported version of Netflix. An option the company had long resisted. But the bleak subscriber numbers and the company's response have stirred a mix of angst and uncertainty among many rank-and-file workers. Some are worried that the streaming heavyweight may have hired too fast and grown complacent as the subscriber growth skyrocketed in the early days of the pandemic. Others are skeptical about strategic shifts and concerned that Netflix's distinct culture is fundamentally changing, according to former employees who spoke with The Times and comments posted on a private Netflix group on Blind, an anonymous forum for people with company-verified email addresses. Now we find ourselves at a company which increasingly looks like every other large tech company, wrote one Netflix employee on Blind, citing changes in compensation policies that are said to favor hiring less experienced engineers at a lower pay. Would they still be doing this if they had hired a little more slowly after the last few years? I think not. So where is accountability for leaders who make the bad decision to overhire? An overriding concern for many is job security, which was magnified on Thursday when Netflix cut an undisclosed number of marketing-related positions, including From Tudum, a publication dedicated to promoting Netflix content. The pop culture site had been touted by former chief marketing officer Bozoma St. John, who exited in March. The company said Tudum remained an important priority. After Netflix released its earnings, some of the workers laid off this week said they had been assured by managers that their jobs were secure. We were basically told, "Don't worry about it," said one former contractor who declined to be named because they signed a non-disclosure agreement. Instead, they were told that Thursday was their last day and that they would receive 2 weeks' severance. "They are leaving a lot of people in an extremely bad position that came here to invest in a project they had sold to us," the contractor said. Further fueling the anxiety is the effect of the steep stock slide. Netflix shares have dropped 70% this year on staff compensation. Employees can choose how much of their pay is tied to stock options. Amid the tumult, rivals have received a surge in job inquiries from Netflix employees, and people familiar with the matter were not authorized to comment publicly. "Do you recommend putting work aside for a bit and start interviewing?" quipped one employee on Blind. Netflix declined to comment for this story. Yeah. I mean, there's more, but we're just going to go through that. Yeah. And we've also got this odd article from Bill Gates, who I don't trust at all.
Yeah.
Bill Gates on the Sunday Times. "I'm grieving the same way Melinda is. A year after splitting from his wife, Bill Gates tells Alice Thompson about being single again and using his fortune to combat the next pandemic." The what?
He's expecting one, huh?
Yeah.
It's almost as if it was pre-planned. No.
But we wouldn't say that on this
platform,
would we?
The platform's limiting speech like other platforms.
Hopefully not. "He had come a long way to this blue lawn, and his dream must have seemed so close that he could hardly fail to grasp it," is the quote from the Gate Gatsby, Bill... The Great Gatsby, which I need to watch the movie of, Bill Gates chose to have inscribed on the dome of his library in Seattle. "Gates picked it," he once told me, "because Gatsby's wooing of his beloved Daisy reminded Bill and Melinda of their courtship." Didn't he nearly have it all? A billionaire by the time he's 31, the brilliant nerdy coder always seemed to get everything right. His company Microsoft led the tech boom by being... What? But led the tech boom? Should be a comma there. But being the richest man alive wasn't enough. Paintings, yachts, and jets soon bored him. He wanted to rescue the world, too. In the next 3 decades, he gave away more than $50 billion to help eradicate polio, eliminate malaria, and save millions of lives. He also developed a reputation as a prophet, having been one of the first to warn the world about climate change and a global pandemic. But it was his marriage to Melinda that set him apart from other Silicon Valley giants, Bezos, Zuckerberg, and Musk. Bill and Melinda, now 66 and 57, seemed like the perfect pair. The first time I met Melinda Gates, Melinda French Gates, evolved to French Gates. They got French architecture now. In Seattle 5 years ago, we talked about Bill and sex. "Of course, I absolutely use contraceptives," she told me, stressing the transformative effects of birth control in developing countries. "Every year, more than 1 billion couples have sex, and yes, not surprisingly, we do too. The couple appeared to adore each other. They had matching glass..."
What year was this?
5 years ago.
I hate to tell her, she doesn't need contraception. She's 57.
Right. "They had matching glass offices with identical desks." Well, she was 50-something. 54?
Yeah. Most women are...
Yeah, yeah. That's post-menopause age. "The couple appeared to adore each other. They had matching glass offices with identical desks. Every day they would drive home discussing vaginal gels and sewage systems and how to save the world." She wasn't
disgusting.
Just some trophy wife. They had 3 children, Jennifer, 26, Rory, 22, and Phoebe, 19, and set up the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, become the world's greatest philanthropists. The economies and computer science graduate and former Microsoft employee would tease her husband when he sounded too pompous, and she kept him grounded and normal. He does the chores, takes the kids to school, and walks the dogs, she told me. This is a man who admits that as a confounder and chief executive of Microsoft, I learned all my employees' number plates off by heart so I could check what time they were leaving every night. When after 7 years they couldn't decide whether to marry, he drew up the pros and cons on a whiteboard. Where he has more facts and stats, she has more heart and emotion. But inside was this very tender, warm-hearted, curious person, Melinda said. To relax, they would meditate, not cross-legged or anything, but on chairs next to each other. Bill once explained to me. They also set up a book club together. He appeared lucky in life and love, too, he said. Their marriage lasted 27 years. Then, a year out of the blue, Melinda and Bill announced they were separating. Suddenly, everything seemed to unravel. Gates was accused of having spent time with the financier and sex offender Jeffrey Epstein before he died, a man Melinda called evil personified, and there were rumors that he may not have been faithful. Overnight, he seemed to slip from sainthood to sinner. How could he have been so careless? I've interviewed Gates 5 times over the past few years in London, Ethiopia, and Seattle. He's a hard man not to like, as he enthusiastically bombards you with figures and graphs. He never appears arrogant, despite being feted by prime ministers and presidents. He is punctilious and courteous. His staff adore him. His mind is constantly whirling as he doodles away on a notepad, though he does expect everyone to keep up. Now, I would be interviewing him in New York. I wondered whether I would be meeting a different man. Would he be contrite or cautious? We were meant to be discussing his latest book, How to Prevent the Next Pandemic. He still loves gadgets. Before our appointment, he sends me an elaborate COVID test with batteries and vials. When we meet at his hotel, where he is prompting his book, he appears to the same, wearing his favorite V-neck jumper, chinos and loafers, and carrying a white tote bag filled with reading material. You've had quite a couple of years, I suggest. Not only has your marriage unraveled, but your father died, and while trying to rescue the world from a pandemic, you have been attacked by anti-vaxxers. He paused. It's been pretty dramatic, he admits, but the weirdest part has been the kids leaving. The youngest just went off to college. She always had 10 friends over. As I come out of the pandemic and we're back to normal, it's actually pretty different. His youngest, he adds, it's just been to see him in New York, so I did get to do some differential equations on infection models with her. I enjoyed that quite a bit. But their vast house in Seattle suddenly seems very empty. Boy, he's really interested in diseases and viruses and chemicals and working with the kids and their research. This is starting to get a little weird, you know. But basically, he said, their vast house in Seattle seems very empty. My wife's graduated as well, so now I'm going to have lots of interesting dinners at the house. I figure a few times a week I'll have various experts come. I have this nice house that lends itself to great discussions, but it feels too big most of the time. I'm only a small-sized person. He says, I'm a data man. He said, Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea responded well at the beginning, but he has been most impressed by Vietnam for its health system messaging and 98% vaccine coverage. It's an outlier, he says. He's a fan of lockdowns, but says countries like Sweden are complicated because despite having lax rules, the population behaved responsibly as though they were locked down, while the U.S. was stricter but had poor rates of compliance. In Hong Kong, as a rare example where they did a brilliant job on lockdowns, but that bred a sense of complacency in vaccinating those most at risk. They went into Omicron with a 35% vaccination rate of over 60s, which is desperate. Meanwhile, Japan is unique because of its obsession with mask wearing. It is the oldest population, but it's lucky because they are also thin, and a lot of death risk relates to obesity and diabetes. There you go. This comes right out of the expert. If you're fat and you have diabetes, you have a bigger chance of dying by COVID. And he said, from the beginning, Gates, who has the world's best epidemiologists and pharmaceutical CEOs in speed dial, believed that a vaccine was the best way to halt the epidemic and started gearing up for production. I thought we'd get them quickly and we'd make them cheaply. I give us a B+ for our vaccines. They have been our greatest weapon. Even the Chinese vaccine, Sinovac, and Russian vaccine work pretty well, he says. Therapeutics have been the greatest disappointment. What? Of course you'd think that. He has money in those companies. Gates appears to treat the virus like an enemy and the pandemic as a war. I do see it as a battle, and the virus is our adversary. I'm constantly wondering whether it's been smarter than us and how it's outwitting us. It should be easier than a war if we are all sharing knowledge and helping each other, he says, but it's been more divisive than I thought. Hold on, I'm still looking. Okay, he's talking about the anti-vaxxers. Okay. He said, what does he say to friends who don't want to get vaccinated? If you're not vaccinated, we don't want to see you? Yeah, that's going from I don't want to see anybody to I only want to see vaccinated people. He won't call the unvaccinated self-obsessed, though he finds it hard to understand why everyone wouldn't want to protect themselves. Gates is also worried that other vaccine programs may suffer. It is the weirdness of the evil of the view of pandemic vaccine spills over to, say, the measles vaccine in developing countries where measles still kills 140,000 kids a year. That's going to be tragic. Some people's refusal to wear masks also baffles him. The degree to which masks block transmission infection is really incredible. The most risky thing I did during the whole pandemic was when I went to the COP26 conference in Glasgow where the infection rate was quite high. The masking plan is very good when we were out on the street, but as soon as you went into the cocktail parties, everyone was drinking with no masks. It was insane. At least I was triple vaxxed. He has never caught COVID. Just pause on that for a second.
Yeah.
He has never caught COVID. Part of him must feel intrigued by the idea of finally meeting his opponent. I'm down to testing like twice a week, and if I feel poorly, my two sisters and their husbands didn't get it. And Melinda and none of my three kids got it either. What?
Might be asymptomatic.
At least one of them wasn't super careful. And at least one of them wasn't super careful. Did he break any rules? Have any rave suitcases of wine? Or of wine, birthday cakes with colleagues? I didn't get the vaccine until it was my turn. I'm learning how to give my own parties now, but I didn't have them the past couple of years. I think most people stick to their bubbles. Partygate perplexes him. I don't know the facts particularly well. I do notice something appears hypocritical, and it has a certain resonance for the people making sacrifices at the time. So I advise him not to have any more parties during pandemics, but I'm not the scold. Let's see. Okay, I'm just going through. Microsoft has done well. Won't say how much money he made during the pandemic. Gates won't say how much money he made during the pandemic. In my case, you have to just for the fact that I was married and now I'm divorced, but I'm still very well off, whereas many people have struggled and many countries' economies have tanked. He thinks that the young, as well as the elderly, paid too high price during the pandemic. In his book, he suggests that schools should be kept open wherever possible in the event of another outbreak. In the inner cities, it's the U.S., you have up to 2 years of learning loss. It's just a super dramatic thing. A lot of care homes were turned into prisons. As the world emerges, okay, let's see. Does anything stop him from sleeping now? Well, I hope we never have to deal with bioterrorism and an internationally caused virus. Lol. But we are making progress in other areas like a cure for HIV. We could cut childhood mortality in half from 1990 to 2020, and we have a chance of cutting it in half again by 2040. We are making huge progress on understanding the microbiome. For the rich world, that means solving overnutrition and the developing world malnutrition. And for the developing world, malnutrition. So that's pretty exciting. What the fuck is overnutrition? Then throw in some Alzheimer's prevention. So despite the polarization and perfect leadership that we have, I still feel very strongly that the human condition is improving.
Well, overnutrition is like obesity.
I guess.
And some people, there are some vitamins that...
Yeah.
Can overdose on.
Right.
I'd have to look it up. I think vitamin A is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few others.
Well, I want to make sure I'm not taking too much magnesium.
Yeah.
Does he feel he's moved on at all? Oh, yeah, this year is very different. He's not known, because I usually take one every day. He's not known as a very emotional person, I say. Melinda, I take a D every day also. I don't know. I'm not... And I mean D by vitamin D, not... I don't know. I'm not visibly emotional. Maybe somewhere deep inside I am. Speaking of D, if you guys are even thinking that, I didn't tell you guys about this. When I went to see my urologist, which, by the way, I'm cool, he wanted me to go on doxycycline. And I was like, no, I'm not going on any more goddamn antibiotics. And by the way, he looked at the cyst. Everything's cool. Like, dude, grabbed my ball or whatever. He said, there's the cyst. And he said, oh, this is fine. This is like a pimple. He shined the light through it. He said, nope, there's nothing wrong with this at all. It doesn't mean anything. If it does, it'll go away. But if you wanted to clear up, just go. I'll give you some medicine for it. And of course, it was 6 weeks of doxycycline, which would fuck me up because I've been taking all kinds of stuff to fix my gut. And now I'd have to redo it again and risk really fucking myself up. Matter of fact, everybody I've talked to, especially people that go see doctors regularly and deal with all that, they told me, do not get on that. I had people 70 fucking years old tell me, no, do not get on that. That'll mess you up. So I am not getting on it, not screwing myself up. I'm building myself back up. I'm doing exercise. I'm lifting weights. I'm feeling better. No way in hell. If this is just a little cyst and it's not cancerous and it doesn't pose a threat and it has no issue and it's like a pimple, then I'm going to deal with a little bit of pain every now and again. Because it's not even like it's bad. It's not like it's, oh no. It hadn't been like that for months. I had that happen one time. But guess what? It goes away as you get, you know, that's what it does. It's supposed to go away within like 4 months. All right, everyone. It's the Grimlord here, and this shit is stitched up like Frankenhooker. Man, it's going to ask if you guys want a date in a minute. I'm sorry I had to do all this, but I had a shitty internet connection, which is weird because I never do, and so far, it seems to be great. I don't know what the fuck was going on. Maybe they were fixing some shit over here. But, I mean, hopefully they got it fixed now. But, looks like I'm going to be able to finish the show that we started with DP. So, obviously, he's not here right now. But, I've done solo shows before, and we still have plenty of articles. Like, I was in the middle of the Bill Gates article, and just everything fucking died. So, we're going to try to do this again and finish your articles up and do the chats and everything else that we normally do. So, just pretend this is a regular article show, and I've even kind of got it live for the people that want to check it out. Of course, Drex is doing his thing, and Nick is doing his thing, and there's just a lot of people doing stuff right now. So, if you're not listening live, that's cool, but if you are, it's awesome and it's appreciated. But for those who aren't, it's going to be everywhere. It'll be on our new YouTube channel. Check it out. The link will be in the description. So, that's Comics and Rants. We're doing something different. I'm not going to be able to do, like, any hentai stuff on YouTube anymore. I'm just going to stick with comics and rants and red pill stuff and just leave it like that. So, that's how we're going to do it from now on and see if that works. I mean, it has YouTube open as a more viable option for some people that might like my content. And, of course, the adult stuff is there, so you know where to find it. I mean, the links are going to be right there. It'll say go to BitChute or MGTOW.TV under Grimlord's Games and Ranch. You'll find it. So, yeah. Anyway, let's go ahead and get started then. Okay, so when we last left off, we were talking about, let's see, there's a lot here. Bill Gates, but we're not going to go back into that. We've done enough of that. Let's share this article from May the 2nd. Okay, so, it's from The Sun. Betrayed, I suggested an open marriage to my husband to spice up our sex life. He then fell for his lover, and I was heartbroken. Well, of course. As Channel 4's new show, Open House, the sex experiment shocks viewers, wife Samantha Presti, 39, reveals what happened when she suggested sleeping with other people. After 9 months of marriage, I could not help feeling there was something missing from my relationship. Alright. A bunch of pictures. My husband, Louis Nitritsos, moved from Greece, Nitritsos, had moved from Greece to London to live with me, and this is when the cracks started to show. Up until then, we had enjoyed a long-distance relationship for 4 years, but now we were arguing about everything from money to work, and our sex life dwindled. I felt suffocated and missed the excitement you get from new love. Restless and bored, I brought up the idea of an open relationship. Naively, I believed free love could reignite our relationship. Louis was terrified that if I started sleeping with another man, I would prefer him, but he reluctantly agreed. I reasoned that having an open marriage would be better than cheating on one another. It was a few months later when I went on my first date with a former flame.
Oof!
As I slipped into my little black dress, I could see the panic spread on Lewis's face. Planting kisses on him, I told him not to worry and that I loved him and would always be his. Around this time, about a year into our marriage, Lewis moved back to Greece to work as a sports instructor for the summer. We agreed I would visit regularly. Our open marriage rules were simple. Always be honest with one another. So when I slept with my ex, I called him straight away. Oof! What a fucking dumbass. Oh, you never do that shit. Of course you're gonna try and get with their exes and fuck them. I imagine him on the beach chatting up girls in bikinis, but he said he wasn't interested in cheating and didn't want other women. So our open relationship was in reality one-sided. She was the one that wanted the open relationship. She could fuck dudes on the side, right? Lewis hated thinking of me with other men, but even though he was crazy with jealousy, he didn't ask for a divorce. He just became more miserable and couldn't get over the fact that I'd slept with another man. I confess I still had feelings for my ex and we'd grown close, which made him feel insecure. More insecure, rather. He couldn't understand how I could love two men at the same time. Although he admitted to kissing other women, he told me he never had sex with them. But the tables turned when I found out that he had been sleeping with someone else too. A friend showed me a loved-up photo of him. He was forced to come clean, and I was heartbroken. But you were the one who fucking did it first! Yeah, it was my idea to have an open relationship, but I felt betrayed because he had lied and hidden it from me. It went against the rules. I felt humiliated. We separated for 2 years, remaining friends, but that trust was lost. Then in 2017, I went on holiday to Rhodes, and we rekindled our love. Due to the long distance, we tried an open relationship again, but this time I made it clear there would be no secret girlfriends. He agreed, and for the first time in years, I felt hopeful about our future. We were even planning on having a baby. But my happiness was crushed when 1 year into our reunion, I found out he'd been sleeping with another British girl. What's more, she didn't respect the idea of a polyamorous marriage and wanted us to break up. She was also in a relationship, and her boyfriend didn't know about the affair. Well, Jesus. Unbeknown to me, she had been flying from Manchester to Greece to see Lewis. I was furious. I made him show me all the messages they had exchanged. As I scrolled through them, I felt sick. Not only had they been secretly seeing each other for the best part of 2 years, but he told her he was in love with her and they were planning to stay together in a monogamous relationship. Furious, I filed for divorce. How could he be trying for a baby with me when he was planning a future with her? We have remained good friends, but our divorce was finalized in December of 2019. It felt like a new beginning. Now I'm living in Willenhall, West Mids, working as a comedian. So good, because, like, that whole thing was a joke. I'm single and dating, but I'd never entertain an open relationship again. The experience has scarred me. I only want one man now, and I hope I'll be enough for him. For those thinking of an open relationship, my message is think twice. I blame myself for my husband's infidelity. Love isn't about rules, it's about honesty and respect. The love between two people is precious and so easy to destroy. It's actually a good cautionary tale. That's why you're not supposed to do that kind of shit. Some people can do the polyamory thing, and some people can't. I mean, well, a lot of people can't. I mean, it's like I was talking with Maya, you know, some people like her, she can do that, but a lot of other people, they can't do it because there's just so much stuff that gets involved and feelings, emotions, all that kind of stuff. It's pretty crazy. Lewis, 37, from Kos, Greece, says, "It was hard when Samantha asked me for an open relationship. I was afraid of losing her and wanted her to be happy. But she told me it would make us stronger. In the end, I agreed, but deep down, I was worried. When I watched her get ready for her first date, I felt very jealous. It was crazy, and I didn't want to know what they got up to. I didn't see any other women for the first year. Then I met this girl and we started sleeping together. Samantha thinks I cheated on her, but I thought I was just doing what she wanted. But she told me I was doing it the wrong way because I didn't tell her. I didn't tell her anything because I thought I was protecting her. I was trying to be a gentleman by sparing her the details. We broke up for 2 years and in that time I saw other women. Then when we got back together, Samantha told me she wanted an open relationship again. But I should have been honest that I was seeing another woman. I'm sorry for hurting her. I hated seeing her upset. Samantha's the love of my life. I still love her and will always love her. I'd never have an open relationship again. I still don't understand it. I was never trying to cheat on her. I just didn't understand the rules." Seems like a mess. And of course, Invader Tech says, oh, look, a blue hair. Yeah, she does have that blue hair, which is weird. Okay, so I'm supposed to discuss this. Although it is something that many of you have probably read before, since it's an ancient article. As I say ancient, I mean like... let's see, about 6 or 7 years ago. 2015. Cool finds. How 1960s mouse utopias led to grim predictions for the future of humanity. John Calhoun studied behavior during overcrowding in mice and rats. Now let's just make sure this isn't 100 million. It doesn't seem like it is. No, I don't want to buy the magazine. What does a utopia look like for mice? According to a researcher who did most of his work in the 1950s and 70s, or through the 70s rather, it might include limitless food, of course, multiple levels, and secluded little rodent condos. These were all part of John Calhoun's experiments to study the effects of population density on behavior. But what looked like rat utopias and mouse paradises at first quickly spiraled out to out-of-control, overcrowding, eventual population collapse, and seemingly sinister behavior patterns. The mice were not nice. For IO9, Esther Inglis Arkell writes about Calhoun's 25th habitat and the experiment that followed. At the peak population, most mice spent every living second in the company of hundreds of other mice. They gathered in the main squares, waiting to be fed and occasionally attacking each other. Few females carried pregnancies to terms, and the one that did seemed to simply forget about their babies. They'd move half their litter away from danger and forget about the rest. Sometimes they'd drop and abandon a baby while they were carrying it. The few secluded spaces housed a population Calhoun called the Beautiful Ones. Generally guarded by one male, the females and few males inside the space didn't breed or fight or do anything but eat and groom and sleep. When the population started declining, the Beautiful Ones were spared from violence and death, but they completely lost touch with social behaviors, including having sex or caring for their young. Well, that doesn't bode well for our society. Not that I'm comparing our society to the mouse experiment. Calhoun's experiments, which started with rats in an outdoor pen and moved on to mice at a National Institute of Mental Health during the early 1960s, were interpreted at the time as evidence of what could happen in an overpopulated world. The unusual behaviors he observed he dubbed behavioral sinks. After Calhoun wrote about his findings in a 1962 issue of Scientific American, that term caught on in popular culture, according to a paper published in the Journal of Social History. The work tapped into the era's feeling of dread that crowded urban areas heralded the risk of moral decay, and events like the murder of Kitty Genovese, though it was misreported, only served to intensify the worry. A host of science fiction works, books like Soylent Green, comics like 2000 AD. I should read a lot more of those in the comic corner, you know. I got a bunch of them. Played on Calhoun's ideas and those of his contemporaries. This work also inspired the 71 children's book Miss Frisbee and the Rats of Nin, which was also made into a 1982 film, The Secrets of Nin, notes the National Institutes of Health. Now, interpretations of Calhoun's work has changed. Inglis Arkell explains that the habitats he created weren't really overcrowded, but that isolation enabled aggressive mice to stake out territory and isolate the beautiful ones. She writes, instead of a population problem, one could argue that Universe 25 had a fair distribution problem. While we can take comfort in the face that humans are not mice, the NIH record spoke to medical historian Edmund Ramston about Calhoun's work. Unfortunately, rats may suffer from crowding. Human beings can cope. And that's not even the cope, like, cope, bro, like actual coping mechanism is what they're talking about. Ramston says, Calhoun's research is not only seen as questionable, but also as dangerous. Another researcher, Jonathan Friedman, turned to studying actual people. They were just high school and university students, but definitely human. His work suggested a different interpretation. Moral decay could arise not from density, but from excessive social interaction, Ramston says. Not all of Calhoun's rats had gone berserk. Those who managed to control space led relatively normal lives. Calhoun's work didn't give us answers, but it is rare that any single study or series of studies can draw definite conclusions. Instead, we have ideas and some strange footage of old experience about mouse utopias. So there you go. A friend of mine wanted me to cover that article. So that's interesting. I mean, there's new interpretations of the experiment, but we don't know for sure. All we know is, you know, that what we've been told from the experiment. And yes, human beings can cope. Obviously, we have a lot of coping mechanisms that we're using right now to deal with these issues. The mice didn't have those. Okay, I'm covering another article here from CNET. Google policy effectively bans outside call recording apps. The change is part of Google's crackdown on apps that use accessibility APIs for non-accessibility purposes. A new Google policy will effectively ban call recording apps from the Play Store starting next month. Under the change, spotted earlier by Ars Technica, call recording will no longer be allowed via Google's accessibility APIs. As part of the tech giant's ongoing crackdown on apps that uses its accessibility APIs, technical workarounds rather than for accessibility reasons. Since the accessibility APIs are the only way for third-party apps to record calls on Android, call recording apps are essentially no longer allowed in the Play Store. The ban is set to officially take effect on May 11th, which means it's happened today. In a statement to CNET, Google said its accessibility APIs are designed with the intent of helping people with disabilities use its devices and software, not for call recording purposes. Though the policy bans the call recording apps from Google's App Store, that doesn't mean Android users will no longer have access to them. Unlike Apple's iOS, the Android operating system is an open one that allows users to download apps from stores other than its own. So expect a lot of these apps to pop up on third-party sites, like APK download, stuff like that. You know what I'm talking about. The practice known as sideloading gives consumers more options, but many security experts say it also opens them up to potential security and privacy risks. And all those security experts can suck my dick, every single one of them. I wonder if they give good blowjobs. There's a reason why aliens haven't visited Earth yet, say scientists. The Fermi paradox questions why aliens have never visited Earth despite the universe being so old, and some what races should have evolved interstellar travel some calling by now. Okay, there was kind of an ad. I wonder if I can get rid of this ad. No, it says why this ad. Stop seeing this ad. Ad covered content. We'll try not to show that ad again. Okay, so can I get rid of the ad? Is the ad gonna go away? Okay. Somewhat racist should have... Okay, we're gonna try that again. Racist should have evolved in some calling by now. Okay. Now, two scientists believe they may have the answer. Astrobiologist Dr. Michael Wong of Carnegie Institute for Science in Washington and Dr. Stuart Bartlett of California Institute of Technology have hypothesized that civilizations burn out when they grow too large and technical. Faced with an ever-growing population and eye-watering energy consumption, worlds hit a crisis point known as singularity, where innovation can no longer keep up with demand. The only alternative to collapse is to abandon unyielding growth and adopt a balance that allows survival, but prevents a society moving any further forward or venturing far from its own spot in the universe. Writing in the Royal Society Open Science, Dr. Wong and Bartlett said, "We propose a new resolution to the Fermi paradox. Civilizations either collapse from burnout or redirect themselves to prioritizing homeostasis, a state where cosmic expansion is no longer a goal, making them difficult to detect remotely. Either outcome, homeostatic awakening or civilization collapse, would be consistent with the observed absence of galactic-wide civilizations." Large civilizations reach crisis points. The pair argue that the general principles of life are universal, and that although the emergence and evolution of life on other planets remains speculative, it may be inevitable. Once on the path, life is likely to follow a similar trajectory to the civilizations of Earth, they claim, eventually organizing into a globally connected state with technology that needs increasing amounts of energy to maintain growth. Using city growth equations, which sets limits on how far societies can scale up, the experts show how large civilizations eventually hit crisis points, which once recognized causes a halt in further growth. The pair point to similar mini-awakenings on Earth, which have prevented global crises such as the de-escalation of weapons of mass destruction since the Cold War, and the ban on CFCs to mend the hole in the ozone layer. However, alien civilizations which are close to burnout may be the most easy to detect, according to the research, because they would be using energy in a wildly sustainable manner, which would provide a good signal emanating from the world. This presents the possibility that a good many of humanity's initial detections of extraterrestrial life may be one of the intelligent, though not yet wise kind, they conclude. Previous explanations. Previous suggestions for why intelligent aliens have not already visited Earth include the discovery of a physical difficulty which makes space travel infeasible, whether related to astronomy, biology, or engineering. Some scientists have suggested that aliens have simply never chosen to visit us, or if they have, we have not noticed, perhaps arriving before humans had evolved. It is also possible that advanced civilizations arose too recently and too far away for aliens to have reached us yet. In 2015, scientists analyzing data from the Hubble and Kepler space telescopes concluded that around 92% of potentially habitable worlds did not exist when Earth formed. So it may be that our solar system is simply ahead of the game. It's very interesting. Well, you know, I think that is a possibility that maybe a lot of these civilizations fucking burned out and died, and that might be what's going to happen to us. We'll just be another dead planet. Kind of like what I think happened to Mars. Let's see here. Here's an interesting one. Daily Wire. I'm just really afraid. Halle Mandel calls Dave Chappelle attack beginning of the end for comedy. Fellow comedians are weighing in on the alleged assault that took place at Dave Chappelle's comedy show Tuesday night. A fan reportedly rushed onto stage, brandishing a blade concealed... Hold on. I didn't want that. There we go. A fan reportedly rushed onto the stage, brandishing a blade concealed in a replica gun at the end of the comedian's set. Netflix is a joke, the festival, at the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles. The man was arrested for felony assault with a deadly weapon and taken to a hospital for medical treatment, CNN reported. Chappelle was not injured. Comedian Halle Mandel conveyed his feelings on the incident while speaking with extras Billy Bush on Wednesday. Watching what happened to Dave last night confirmed my fear, Mandel said. I was watching it kind of live on Twitter and turned to my wife and I said, I don't want to. I don't want to go on stage. I'm just really afraid. And, you know, Halle Mandel has a lot of problems with his mental state anyway. So that's definitely not good for him. Some comedians attending the show rushed to Chappelle's side after it happened. Chris Rock was one of them. Video surfaced later of Rock saying, was that Will Smith? After the attack, referencing the now infamous slap at the 2022 Academy Awards. Rock wasn't the only one talking about Smith's slap following the incident. Comedian Washington Times columnist Tim Young tweeted, we can all thank Will Smith for setting the example that led to Dave Chappelle getting assaulted on stage last night. You know, that could partway be true. Mandel had similar sentiments to share while speaking to Extra. This is one step that kind of opens a door and triggers somebody if they don't like what you're saying or they're offended by what you're saying. It's kind of okay because it's been done to be violent, and that's what my fear was, the America's Got Talent host explained. My biggest fear 40 years ago was not getting a laugh, and then cancel culture came along, and then it was like, oh my god, if somebody doesn't like your joke or you ever step your line, you could lose your career. And then after the Academy Awards, I said, violence triggers violence, Mandel concluded. You saw what happened at the Academy Awards. And I thought, that just triggers violence. That just triggers violence, triggers violence. The 66-year-old star told E! News, I think this is the beginning of the end for comedy. It's really sad. When asked how he'd react to being attacked, Mandel said, I'm probably more of a Chris Rock and an Usain Bolt. Because I would run, he joked. I wouldn't stand there. I would fight back. I wouldn't fight back, and I would just run. He also called himself a wuss. Yeah, comedy is really fucked, folks. It is absolutely fucked. Speaking of Netflix, Netflix slammed for actively recruiting black women and laying them off months later. Netflix thought they'd get accolades for making so many diverse hires. That strategy backfired, but the company had to do layoffs months after launching the fan website Tudum. Now that the company is facing public outcry that a number of minority employees... Hold on. Now the company is facing public outcry that a number of minority employees lost their jobs. According to TechCrunch, the company laid off editorial staff from its in-house publication Tudum only 5 months after launching the new venture. More than 10 writers tweeted about being let go, including an editorial manager. The publication indicated that 25 people in Netflix marketing department were affected by the decision. A Netflix spokesperson told the outlet, "Our fan website Tudum is an important priority for the company." It is worth mentioning that Netflix actively recruited black women and people of color just to lay them off months later without a second thought, journalist Monique Judge shared on Twitter. Don't brag about being inclusive when you treat your diversity hires like they're disposable. Affected staff were full-time, part-time, or on contract. Most of them had just been given promotions the month prior to layoffs, according to Madame Noir. Okay. The publication noted that employees were only offered 2 weeks of severance pay. Netflix recruited me 7 months ago, only to lay me and a bunch of other talented people off today. I'm going to take time off just to exist, so please get in touch if you have editing and content strategy opportunities open after August, one woman tweeted along with her contact information. Well, I just was laid off from a significant contract originally intended through August, so I'm looking for stable work and rent. I need rent, Nicole Perkins tweeted. One ex-Tudum employee told NPR, they went very out of their way to hire high-level journalists of color who have quite a bit of name recognition and a lot of experience and talent. In some ways, they were just buying clout to lend credibility to their gambit. We recorded pretty aggressively. They sold us on the most amazing thing that you could want as a culture journalist or entertainment journalist, the former staffer continued. They just sold something that seemed impossible anywhere else, but the biggest selling point was the pay. People upended their lives for this. The streaming service made headlines when it admitted to losing 200,000 subs in the first quarter of 2022, making its first subscriber loss in more than a decade. The company expects to lose 2 million subscribers globally in Q2. Netflix responded by raising prices for customers, which could encourage more cancellations, and vowing to crack down on password sharing. So, all right, that's what we're going to do today. So I added a couple more articles to what we had, and I think that's going to be enough. I've got other things I got to cover, but when we get back with DP on next Sunday, we're going to start with the virtual reality kissing article, which I know you guys want to hear about, and then some other things. But for now, this will be the Grim Lord, and I am out of here. I'll see you next time, and enjoy the menu.